Marlo.
Hey, just leaving now. Where are you calling from? No, I'll meet you at your place. Yep. See you soon. The sun was setting. I locked my inner office up and left the waiting room open. I started for the corridor when I decided to take the stairs. I wasn't trying to hold out on young Joe Briggs, but the exercise would give me some time to think. I took this case because I needed the dough, but something definitely wasn't right. If Ruth Moriarty was afraid of her husband's business associates, then I could see her not wanting to go to the police. But that would also only cast blame on herself if he really was dead. I walked down the back staircase filled with cigarette butts and month-old newspapers and went out the door to my car. The November air in Los Angeles always seems to get a little bit crisper around supper time. I've got an old hunk that Ford might have worked on as a party gag, but it still starts and stops when I need it to, and it's pretty inconspicuous. With enough prayer, it can even crawl up driveways silently. The evening traffic was heavy. Pedestrians darted out from different angles like Frankie Frisch trying to steal home. I drove up Franklin Avenue, hung a right on Western, took that to Bay City, and made another right turn. Even in this little poor bungalow section of town, the building seemed to tower over me as I drove. Why did my life feel like alleyway craps on the side of some casino? Maybe the cigarette smoke was just getting to me. I rolled down my window. But that's when I noticed it. Two cars back, a blue sedan followed. I had seen it parked down the block when I got into my car, but I hadn't paid much attention other than that. I wondered what he wanted, but I wasn't curious enough to let him find out where I was going. I decided to shake him. The only time I like a tail job is when I'm doing the tailing. It takes no guts to stay 15 feet behind someone to follow them for information. Sitting across from a guy and demanding answers, now that's tough. By the way, I want my tombstone to read, "Here lies Philip Marlowe." He was only half smart, but hey, at least he had guts. I turned left on Rossmore and again on Wilshire, all the while dodging in and out of the evening rush of traffic. He stayed behind me until three kids tossing a football jumped out in front, causing him to stop short. Imagine that. Kids playing in the streets of Los Angeles at dusk. I quickly turned up Olympic, and then again on La Cienega and doubled back. The blue sedan was gone. I was heading over to Bernie Old's house on the other side of town. Bernie's a good man. I did 2 years of college with him at Stanford. He was now the district attorney's chief investigator and one of the few who wasn't corrupt. I wanted his opinion on this case, and besides, Bernie had been kind enough to invite me over for dinner on his 30th birthday. I stopped at a drugstore along the way and picked up a liter of brandy as a gift. There was no sign of the blue sedan or anyone else tailing me. By the time I got to Bernie's, it was completely dark. My watch said 7 p.m. Bernie Olds was standing in his doorway, clean-shaven and fit as ever, with a full head of red hair, a good complexion, and light blue eyes that looked at me scornfully.
You're late. The food I picked up from the Derby's getting cold.
Sorry, Bernie. I got hung up giving some tail job the slip on the way over here.
That's so. New case, what's the story?
We walked inside and down three steps into Bernie's sunken parlor, complete with two leather chairs, a sofa, a coffee table, a standing radio in the corner, and several plants. Straight back of the front door was a perpendicular set of stairs that led up to the bedrooms. On the left was a dining room. There were stacks of books on the ash-colored table. Behind the dining area were doors. They led to the kitchen. Bernie took my coat and hat. His wife Kathy had recently divorced him. Nice girl. I knew her in college. No patience. Bernie's all patience. That's why he's still with the DA. She took the train back to Philadelphia and said to hell with him and the entire coast. Somehow, he managed to keep his house. I hear she's seeing a chemist.
What's in the brown bag?
Cognac.
Hennessy?
Mm-hmm. Just what Ray Wilbur would have ordered.
It's nice to know that in these trying times, there's still a guy who knows my taste, Phil. Sit. Come on, serve yourself. Don't stand on ceremony.
On a kitchen table that could seat comfortably four, were two huge trays of spaghetti and meatballs. As we ate, I explained the events of the afternoon.
What does Spokane have to do with this whole mess?
It's Spokane, Bernie. I don't understand why nobody can pronounce this place. I'm gonna take a trip up to Big Bear tonight after I leave. And if that doesn't give me any answers, I guess I'll contact this guy Robard and see what the story is.
What about Benny Chance? We both know how rough he plays.
Benny Chance, who ran the Krypton Club, was tough and smooth, like a tire iron wrapped in silk. You name the racket, he had a hand in it.
Hey, I'll make some coffee. I want to try out this new French press.
Ernie Oles told me that Benny had several arrests, but only twice had been to prison. The first time was in 1923, when he was convicted for tax evasion. The second was the one I remembered. While on parole, a rookie cop caught Benny with a gun. He was by himself and actually didn't kill the kid. The state had the decency to send him back to prison to finish his sentence proper. As Bernie made coffee, we continued. The way I see it, if something did happen to John Moriarty, then Benny would be a good place to start. Now, Ruth Moriarty claims she hates her husband but hasn't reported him missing, supposedly out of fear. But let's just say I'm not totally trusting of the whole situation.
Big Bear's a long drive, Phil. And if Chance did have Moriarty knocked off at the lake, don't you think he'd have someone watching it and would have done his best to dispose of all the evidence?
That was true. As far as having disposed of all the evidence, there'd be nothing I could do about that. On the other hand, if he hadn't and had someone watching the cabin, one man on foot who wasn't known in that circle could possibly get close enough to see. Bernie got up and poured me a cup of coffee from the French press he was brewing.
Phil, when are you going to learn to stop leaning in with your chin? You'll need my Colombian Java just to make sure you don't fall asleep at the switch.
I slugged it down and joked that Kathy's boyfriend's love of chemistry was rubbing off on him. Bernie was in good spirits. That was good for me in case I needed to call in a favor. He told me, with all the acid we'd just eaten, I'd better use his restroom before the drive. I thanked him for the meal and promised one in return if I was living in 2 weeks. He walked me to the door and we shook hands. He told me to be careful. I wished him a happy birthday. I left Bernie's at 9. I wanted to get to Big Bear as late as possible. The less attention I attracted, the better, you know? It was easy driving. The weather was clear. It wasn't unbearably cold. No one followed me, from what I could tell. The one time I had been to Big Bear was 1932, the year before the Pan Hot Springs Hotel burned down. For years, it had been a resting ground for movie stars and other members of the upper crust who wanted to get away from the world. I don't have that kind of time for such leisurely activities. I'm too busy counting pennies. Maybe someday I'll marry rich. I took the canyon roads as I got closer to the Gold Mine Mountain Resort. Finally, a main entrance approached. I saw in the distance a well-lit guard box. There was a toll booth to prevent cars from driving in unnoticed. Guards even at this hour? I wonder if they have a union. Parked my car a ways up the road in the bushes. For a minute, I just sat there being quiet, making sure I didn't attract any attention. Then I took a pint of Jim Beam out of the glove box. 2 gulps later, I grabbed a flashlight and put on a pair of black gloves. Then I holstered my gun. I got out of the car and walked slowly down the road, staying in the shadows and looking out for people. No cars passed. It was off season. The skiers wouldn't show up until December. The summer crowd, they were back in Bel Air for Thanksgiving. When I got within 200 feet of the main entrance, I snuck through the woods to get by the guard. There were a series of cabins located, a few hundred yards back or so over a small hill. The hills themselves are covered with sweeping evergreens, probably there since the time of the Serrano Indians. It was eerie. I felt my own mortality. Go there one winter night. I promise you'll understand desolation. I soon found the first cabins. There's one, there's two. Moriarty's, it's down the road. I kept to the shadows. The only light was that of the mid-November half moon. Passing cabin number 7, I stepped on a branch. My heart jumped, and I held my breath. The below-freezing wind whistled gently by. The northern lights twinkled above. I stood there for what seemed like an eternity. No wolves howled. No owls hooted. When I was finally satisfied that no one heard, I kept on. I located Moriarty's cabin. It had a large, gilded number 16 hammered into the door. I could barely make it out in the moonlight. It was a one-floor ranch, a well-built wood. Somewhere, Abe Lincoln was nodding. There were no lights on inside, nor in any of the neighboring cabins, for that matter. There were no voices either, but there was a car parked 30 or so feet away. It looked like an apparition in the dim light. I asked myself, why did I bother to bring a flashlight if I was too afraid to use it? I crept over to the car. It was a lime green 1934 Skoda 420 convertible with a ragtop roof. No one was inside. The driver door was unlocked. The whole car was ice cold. It probably hadn't been driven in at least a day. I switched on my flash to take a look inside. The car lit up like a gigantic June bug. I wanted to yell the most vulgar obscenities I could think of at myself. If anyone was around, they were better at hiding than me. There were no papers in the glove compartment. Nothing at all to identify its owners inside the car. I got out. Closed the door lightly, craning my head to hear sounds. When I was sure no one was around, I crept back over to the cabin and looked in the window. I could make out a large bed in the corner. It was unmade. No one was in it. I didn't see any movement at all, so I decided to go around and try the back door. When I got to the door, I found it slightly ajar. That surprised me. Using both hands, palms spread, I gave it a slow push, but the damn thing wouldn't budge. Something on the other side had to be in the way. A thick sickness rose in me. Ooh, my throat wanted to close. I looked around again to make sure no one was watching. You have to understand, paranoia is part of this profession. I slowly shined my flash into what was a kitchen. Then I saw why I couldn't open the door, and I forced my way in. I took deep breaths, exhaling slowly, trying to steady my heart. My hands were buzzing with adrenaline. She had been slumped up against the door. My eyes squinted. My tongue was dust dry. There was a bullet hole in her bare stomach above her navel, and another in her neck. She had bled out all over the floor. Her face was frozen with horror and agony. This woman had not died quickly. I wanted to look away, but I didn't recognize her. It was awful. Then, placing a handkerchief over my mouth, trying to breathe, I noticed that her shoes were off and her feet were charred black and badly burned. I bent down, grabbed her right wrist, then her left. Rigor mortis had long since set in. I carefully looked. There were rope marks on both of them. I slowly tiptoed my way into the cabin, gun drawn, flash in my other hand, still taking deep, slow breaths. The cabin was ice cold. I'll never forget that. At least it had kept the scent and any nearby animals at bay. I walked past the kitchen into the other room. The bed was on the right side. To my left on the opposite wall was a fireplace that had long since gone out. On the near wall, attached to the kitchen, and to the left of the bed, was a large, floor model Atwater Kent radio. Fancy. There was an oval table with enough canned goods on it to last 2 weeks, and three chairs. He was slumped in the far chair, completely nude, with his hands tied behind his back, and his head tilted, as if in some sort of sustained roar. His feet were raised, so the backs of his heels were resting on the table. His ankles were tied together. On his right foot, three toes had been cut off. I saw numerous small stab wounds on his arms and his thighs. And as I got close enough practically to kiss him, I saw his right ear was gone. And Lord help me, so were his genitals. A pool of dry blood had coagulated in his lap. There was blood everywhere. It looked like varnish. His throat had been cut too, from ear to ear. A small bone protruded. I couldn't tell if that came first or last. I guessed last. His eyes were wide open. Using my right thumb and index finger, I gently shut them. On cold, lonely nights, I still see this man's face, and I thank God I'm not in Big Bear. I will never wish anyone enter a room where murders like this were committed. It's almost as if the energy of horror is left behind after their deaths. There was a strong smell in this interior room of dry blood and burnt flesh, but not as strong as it would have been had that back door not been slightly open, which allowed that cold air in to keep these people from rotting. I shined the flash in the fireplace. I saw three small bones, white against the ashes. His three toes. I looked at him. Lord, I looked at him. He was clean-shaven and older-looking, with blondish hair that had begun to gray at the temples. This was not John Moriarty. I saw a pair of trousers lying by the bed. I went through the trouser pockets quickly and found a wallet. Inside the wallet was a driver's license with a name, Paul Robard. Paul Robard, who had organized a trip to a Spokane, Washington mine. Paul Robard, who had struck gold with John Moriarty, Benny Chance, and possibly any number of partners. My knees were weak, I guess. I was both floating and sick as a dog. My nerves were buzzing uncontrollably. I'm not untough. There's no amount of tough that can prepare you for that. This whole setup was dead wrong. I decided quickly, I better get the hell out of there. As I tiptoed to the door, I noticed something else along the table. A gold nugget was lying there along with the manuscript. I picked them both up. I quietly moved past the poor woman and out the back door. I crept around to the front and back down the road. My stupid jalopy was parked right where I left it. No one was around. No cars drove by as I got in the passenger side and slid over. Put the nugget and the manuscript in the glove compartment. Took out that damn bottle of Jim Beam and glugged as much as I could stomach. I turned the car on. I drove, craning, leaning practically on the dashboard. I kept my lights off for a mile or so, headed south to Los Angeles. I couldn't tell you if I blinked the whole way back.
Was down where fisher folk gather. I wandered far from the throng. I heard a fisher girl singing, and this refrain was her song. Red sails in the sunset.
You've just heard The Advice and the Horror, the second in a six-part miniseries called A Man Named Marlowe, based on the character of Philip Marlowe, originally developed by Raymond Chandler. Tonight's story was written, produced, and directed by James Scully. Heard in tonight's cast were Dan Mountain as Bernie Olds, with James Scully as Philip Marlowe. Now, here's James Scully to tell you about the next episode, The Aftershock and the Proposition, which will be available beginning June 12, 2018.
Thank you. Next time on A Man Named Marlowe, after a trip to an all-night diner, a few things begin to make sense as our hero is given the opportunity to drop the case for a large sum of money. Will he walk away?
Be sure to subscribe to this series on iTunes and everywhere you get your podcasts by searching for Breaking Walls or at thewallbreakers.com. If you've enjoyed the first two episodes of A Man Named Marlowe, give us a quick iTunes rating so more people can discover the show. By the way, available in the same feed is Breaking Walls, a documentary series on the history of the American radio broadcasting. Most recent episode, number 79, chronicles the career of Orson Welles between 1931 and 1941. Both of these shows are available by searching for Breaking Walls wherever you get your podcasts, or by going to thewallbreakers.com. To support these shows for as little as $1 a month, please go to patreon.com/thewallbreakers. In the coming weeks, outtakes, insights, and soundscapes from A Man Named Marlowe will be added. This is Olga Lysenko speaking. Thank you and good evening.
Swift wings you must borrow, make straight for the shore. We marry tomorrow, and he goes sailing no more. Red sails in the sunset, way out on the sea. Oh, carry my loved one home safely to